Hello there. Yes, welcome to Life Matters on your radio for the next hour. Natasha Mitchell in the chair with you on ABC RN. We have powerful stories of memory, of history, of childhood today. You won't want to miss acclaimed Australian children's author Nadia Wheatley, who has captivated generations of big and little readers alike. Her new book, Flight, taps into, well, her own childhood story in unexpected ways, as you'll hear, and into one of the most vexed plights of our times. Really looking forward to Nadia joining me here in the Life Matters studio in the second half of the hour. And in a moment, families and couples will speak with profound stories about what happens when dementia robs you of English, your second language, and you revert to your mother tongue. Before we get to that, let's squeeze in a few of your calls from the week. We talked tomboys on Tuesday. Whether the term, the identity, still has currency today. To be a girl today who is active, who climbs trees, who doesn't go for the pink frills. Put your hands up. I did. Why would that make you any less of a girl? Here's a call.
Hello, Natasha. My name's Irene. I'm in Queensland. About being a tomboy, I grew up in the UK in the 50s and early 60s and was simply not interested in doing anything that the girls were doing. I refused to wear dresses at age 10 and demanded my elder brother's jeans and striped pajamas. I was out playing pirates, cops and robbers, cowboys and Indians with the boys. And my friend, who was also a tomboy, we used to go out catching tadpoles, climbing trees, falling in rivers, tearing clothes. And as a kid also, I wouldn't join the Brownies. I wanted to join the Cubs and the Scouts because they did more interesting things. I never wanted to be a boy. Mm. I just wanted to do what they did.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
And thank you. I relate. We got some great email stories too, which I hope to get to throughout the week or into next week. We launched this week with hilarious and hellish stories from living in a strata arrangement in a flat or a townhouse, from nude gardeners to, well, pigs inside the spare bedroom in one of your neighbours. Here are some calls.
I'm Cheryl and I live in on a strata title in suburb of Melbourne, and you mentioned the smoking and drifting and smoking and passive smoke and danger to health. I have a tenant who's in a unit, all the others are unoccupied, and the tenant in the opposite unit keeps smoking outside. The smoke goes all over the common property, but the worst thing, which I've taken up with my body corporate manager, the smoke, I can smell it inside my private home and I'm sick and tired. If they want to smoke, they should smoke inside or in their backyard or courtyard, provided it does not go out onto common property or, worse, into someone else's private home. Thank you.
Hi, Natasha. My name's Harold. I live in a large residential building in the city, and my experience is largely to the opposite of what I've been hearing on the program today. And in the building that we live in, there's really another side. We have in-house management. We have a 24-hour concierge. There is a community clearing about the building. There are a large number of interest groups. We've got a coffee club, there's a garden club, a tennis club, a book club, a trivia group, and also a craft club. These people get together very regularly. I couldn't speak more highly of strata living if I'd really tried very hard. There is another side to it.
I want what you're having, Harold. That's a great call. And we love hearing from you, our listener feedback line for your stories, your responses, your rants, your raves, your peeves, 02833 1430. Or join us on Facebook this morning, or you can tweet us at RN Life Matters. Are you one of the almost 350,000 Australians now living with a diagnosis of dementia? It will be a million of us by the middle of the century, according to one prediction. We are a culturally diverse population. More than 300 languages are spoken in Australian households. As dementia develops, the way we communicate with each other often needs to change too. Sometimes words and language, as we had them, disappear. But touch and presence and music and photos take over as ways of communicating. An added complication here, perhaps, is that migrants who've learned English in adulthood often lose their ability to speak and communicate in that second language as their disease progresses. And they can even revert back to their mother tongue. For Life Matters, Pablo Vinales went to meet families grappling with this experience.
Lipo ante, lipo, lipo.
No, me tu ma tu
lipo means beautiful. Lipo?
Ne moj pidati, ali ja neću. And I go in here.
Something to do with going. You're going, Anthony?
Huh?
Where are you going?
Kada?
Where are you going? Where are you going, Anthony?
Yeah.
Where? I realized he was speaking less and less English and he wasn't understanding something that we always spoke English together. And he wasn't understanding what I was saying. And even if there was a phone call, he couldn't talk on the phone. Probably if I knew Croatian better, maybe he would least pick up the first sentence. But in English, well, he has no idea. No idea.
Is there anything you wish you could tell him?
Yeah.
It's okay, sorry.
Probably to tell him not to worry, that he's safe and I will help to keep him that way. Don't worry, dobro ante.
This is a story about two soulmates who have found themselves lost in translation.
Croatia was not accepted. I knew, I respect it was my husband's country and, you know, and my children, their father, you know, and their heritage. But, I never really paid attention to the language before. I know I should have, but you know, you're every day, we're working, the children, and we're all communicating in English, so.
When Francesca Concurat met her husband, Anthony, English was a language they could both understand. She's Italian and he's Croatian. They've been married for 36 years and raised their children speaking English. But when Anthony was diagnosed with dementia 6 years ago, it wasn't just names or places he started to forget. It was English.
Half the time it's like sign language or few words that I know, like, are you hungry or are you thirsty? Did you want to go to the bathroom? Only those, or just lead him or just offer things to him and see if he'll take it, basically. Because my Croatian is improved a little bit, but it's not fluent. So I'm just sort of picking up. In the last few years, I know that I have to start to learn.
Imagine not being understood. You're telling your loved one, your daughters, your husband, what you're thinking about, what you want to do, and you're speaking to them and they just don't understand what you're saying to them. It's hard to imagine for us because language is such a common factor between human beings. But to be unable to understand what your loved one is saying to you and the fact that they can't understand you must be exceedingly frustrating for the person with dementia. Now, as the dementia develops, they lose some of that ability to analyse. But for the loved one, the carer, it becomes a shocking burden.
John Watkins is the CEO of Alzheimer's Australia New South Wales. He, along with other experts like Lee Fay-Low from the University of Sydney, believe the issue of dementia in migrant communities is only going to get worse.
There are about 350,000 people with dementia in Australia at the moment. We know that about a third of people over 60 are from non-English-speaking backgrounds, so weren't born in Australia. So that means that there are about 115,000 people with dementia who weren't born in Australia. The projection suggests that there'll be 900,000 people with dementia in Australia by 2050. So about 300,000 of those people would have been born outside Australia.
As a psychologist and associate professor in ageing and health, Li Fei Lo has spent years researching the impact dementia has on older people from non-English speaking backgrounds.
When someone gets dementia in the brain, basically bits of the brain die or atrophy. So cells die and connections between cells die. When we think of dementia, we often think of Alzheimer's disease, in which memory is the first thing to deteriorate. There are other types of dementia where you might see other symptoms besides memory. This is an analogy, not exactly how the brain works, but if you think of your memory system in your brain like a tube of Pringles, with the memories right at the bottom of the tube are the ones that you got first, and you put more and more in over the top. What happens in dementia is that you lose your latest memories first. So your short-term memories, things that happened last week, they're what you forget first. And so it ebbs away, you eat away at the Pringles at the top of the tube till you get to the ones at the bottom, which are your more early memories. So if you learnt English as a second language, say as an adult, then you would lose those memories and those skills.
Oh,
very good, Anthony. That's good.
But not if was what the bloody Mike Borgia.
That's when he says my emotion, I think he's saying, oh my God.
Yeah.
We met through a friend when I was working in the city. And she said, I have a Croatian friend that's working in the Imperial Arcade. He's doing some decorating, painting and decorating. Come and we'll meet him for coffee. And that's how it all started. This was when the children were little. That's Angelina, that's Christian. Yeah, that's Anthony there. We're at the beach. We love the island, so we were in the island somewhere. Everyone was his friend. Everyone that he used to meet, if they weren't his friend, they'd become his friend. Yes, I couldn't sit in the coffee shop with him without him wanting to know everyone that was in the coffee shop too.
How would you describe your father to someone who doesn't know?
He was always, I shouldn't say was, but he isn't really with us technically, very charismatic, was always very loud and in a way obnoxious in his own way, but he was definitely a big character.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. You hear me? You hear me?
Yes!
Right, thank you. I appreciate you come tonight in my beautiful girl, Angelina. I know give to her a lot of everything what I want to do in this life, but I always respect her. She's have a knowledge and she's have a personality. And thank you, gentlemen, of you, because you come here tonight, enjoy yourself what you can, doesn't matter how much cost.
Dad always loved to give a speech. That was just him. He was quite loud and, you know, always liked to be involved. And as mentioned, I think he was always proud of us, so he always liked the opportunity to talk.
For Angelina, Anthony's daughter, her father's larger-than-life persona lives in a speech he gave at her wedding just after he was diagnosed.
That particular speech at the wedding and previous discussions, I think, you got to see his personality.
Because life, my life, is the most beautiful life in the planet.
Now, all that remains are lost words and muttering.
That's terrific.
That's terrific, Anthony.
So he sometimes gets little pockets of
yeah,
English.
Like you just said, that's terrific, but I have no idea what he's confusing something with. I'm not quite sure. See, because he doesn't pick up things the way they are. Something else is in his mind.
Like most people living with dementia, Anthony lives at home and in the community. Just the thought of Anthony in a nursing home is too painful for Francesca.
You know what? I block it out. I know I shouldn't, but I block it out. I don't want to think about it because I think it would be too upsetting that I wouldn't be there. Someone that he knows and is familiar with is not going to be there with him all the time. And it would just break my heart that he would feel lost in some way. Yeah, I want to protect him from that.
Μαλο πω μαλο και μόλι υποβρώ και όχολο πάτε σαν το κιόμπι. Πάτε σου υποβεί το ας.
Thank you, thank you.
Ε, δείτε σκακό εσύ.
Γιο βίντε βοβό.
It was very traumatic. It was sad, traumatic. It was, I felt guilty. I felt ashamed that I couldn't look after my mother. And then I think, well, what if something happened and I wasn't there for that 10 minutes that something happened? I'd blame myself. And I'd be guilty all my life. I still feel guilty. I feel guilty because I didn't want to put my mum in a home, but there was no other way. And it was the hardest decision I've had to make.
Mary Benicevich recently made the difficult decision to send her mother, Mara, into a nursing home.
My mother was diagnosed with dementia about a year and a half ago. She was at home for a while with us, but it just got to the point where it wasn't safe for her anymore and she'd always want to go home.
For the families of people living with dementia, the decision to send their loved one into full-time care is difficult enough. But for migrant families, this decision is distressing for another reason, the language barrier.
When she was at the English-speaking nursing home, she was very down and she was always, always angry, always angry. She just didn't have any idea what was going on. Everything that she did was in her room. She couldn't speak English at all by this stage. She could only say hello and thank you. I actually used to go there every day from morning to night to interpret, to see what she needed. You know, she was to have a shower. I'd tell her to go and have a shower and so forth. And she'd get really angry because when people try to explain to somebody who can't speak English, they think that by yelling at them, they're going to understand them more. But in fact, it made her even worse. So it made her very, very angry and very agitated.
That is the biggest trauma for the people with dementia. We know that they live in their space, which is limited.
Maria Oreskovich understands the struggle Mary and her mother Mara have been through. She's a link worker in Sydney's Croatian community.
My role is to give information about dementia, to connect the people with adequate services.
It's like having an advocate for you, someone who has experience in the dementia field, who has a sense of what the challenges are, who can speak to you in your language, can be an interpreter, if you will, and someone who can advocate on your behalf.
Alzheimer's Australia employ link workers from various cultural backgrounds to help bring down the barriers migrant families confront. It's because of services like these that Mary has been able to find a nursing home that can actually communicate with her mother.
Where she is now, 99.9% of the staff are Croatian. So whatever she can still understand, she understands because they tell her in her own language. If she's not well, she will say, you know, my arms are sore, my legs sore. So they can understand her, they can help her. They don't yell at her because they don't need to yell, and it is an extremely good facility.
Pablo, this is my mum, Mara.
Hello.
Oh, hello, thank Pablo. You. Thank you very much.
Yes. Now, I've just come to see her. We've taken her outside. We had a concert this morning. And, she's really happy today, which is good. So we have our bad days and good days.
How often do you come to see her?
I come about 5 days a week, but I'm going to start cutting down a little bit because I feel that she's getting used to her surroundings and people are looking after her really well. So
I went there a couple of days ago and she was so glad to see me. And I hugged her and she gave me a hug back. And I really don't think I need to say anything because that was like she knew that I was there and I was holding her and that. Oh, God, I'm getting upset again.
Okay.
Sorry.
These personal experiences with dementia are just the tip of the iceberg in a situation experts say will only get worse.
There's a crisis that is certainly coming. I'm careful about using that sort of language because if there is a real commitment from government, we can make changes quickly. But at the moment, I'm not comfortable that there is an acceptance of it. And then you look at specific groups and their challenges are even worse. They've got added burdens, added challenges to everyone else.
Awareness is only the beginning of the fight against dementia.
We do our best to deliver services, and we've got some resources that we've argued for and received government funding for, and we're grateful for that. But we simply do not have sufficient services available, not just for us, but in the wider community. So there should be a network of support workers that support every community, every language group in Australia.
This.
I'm not quite sure what
this
what
is
saying.
Swash,
but what? That's all in Croatian.
Yeah. So I'm not quite sure. I'm sure he would. He was mixed up whatever he was saying, but I didn't catch any of it except that he was trying to say, yes, he likes. Things that I give him sometimes, things to keep him occupied.
You obviously care for Anthony a lot. How much do you love him?
Oh, too much. Too much. That's what hurts, I think, because, I miss Anthony.
Dushka.
It's sad. I don't want him to see me that I'm upset.
Oh.
He won't know what's going on.
No.
I'm okay, Anthony. I'm okay.
For now at least, Francesca's selfless love for Anthony speaks through the language barrier, and it's her memories that keep her going.
I'm so happy when I look back, think back, really. I got photos of, got one in the fridge that I look all the time. When Anthony and I were in New York, and I look at this every day, and it has beautiful memories of that trip.
And Pablo Vinales with that very important feature this morning on Life Matters on the experience of migrant families and dementia, especially after language goes. And our thank you, heartfelt thanks to Anthony and Francesca Concurat and their daughter Angelina and Mara and Mary Benicevic for sharing their story with Pablo. Their stories illustrate the challenges, and we want to delve a little further into what sorts of tailored support people, their families, need to meet some of these challenges, especially in aged care environments and in culturally sensitive and appropriate ways. What's possible? What's needed? What's realistic? John Watkins, the CEO of Alzheimer's Australia, was featured in Pablo's story, and he joins me in the Life Matters studio now. Good morning to you, John.
Morning, Natasha.
And also we're joined by clinical psychologist Dr. Susanna Runci. She was a researcher at the former Aged Mental Health Research Unit at Monash University. It wound up last year. Thanks for joining us, Susanna.
Good morning, Natasha.
Morning to you. John, when you hear the stories of the families that we just heard from, what do you feel in your advocacy role?
I'm still overwhelmed by the bravery of people and how they deal with the challenge that they face. It tells you a lot about humanity and the strengths that there are in all of us, and frustrated at the same time that these people are, generally speaking, going through this challenge alone without the level of support that they should expect from our community. If English is not your second language, if English is your first language, dealing with dementia is tough enough, and there are services available. But a lot of those services become very difficult to access if English is your second language and it is a language that is lost due to the encroachment of dementia.
We heard about couples who'd made the difficult decision to place their family member in an aged care residence. In many migrant families, though, Families care for their elders within the home, don't they? And it's a duty. It's a duty that they expect of themselves. And I wonder if that's an added burden as well, and further kind of isolates them as a family.
Look, sometimes we're talking about multiple cultures here, so it's very difficult to draw, conclusive. Results that apply to everyone. And certainly some cultures give us demonstrate to us so well how a family unit together can really support someone with dementia. But there are other cultures where dementia is not known, often even not named in the language, where it equates with madness, where there's a lot of stigma involved as well. That's also common in the wider community in Australia, I have to say. But certainly we get great examples of good family care from many different ethnic communities. So too across the wider breadth of Australia.
That lack of even a word for dementia in some languages is an issue that you've addressed in some way at Alzheimer's Australia, haven't you?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things we try to do, and the best resource, I think, in this area that I've seen is it's not a disgrace, it's dementia, which now is in 11 community languages, filmed, made with the support of the local community, where we talk about an individual circumstances such as we've heard this morning and talk to a community leader and then try to push that out into the community. So especially where those communities, where there is a level of stigma or lack of understanding, this is often very useful. And we've had great success. Mm. The Croatian resource that we've created has actually been adopted back in Croatia and in the UAE, of all places, as a resource that they use in their teaching.
Susanna Runcie, what is the evidence, as you know it, that culturally tailored care and particular services in people's first languages results in better outcomes for people with dementia in terms of their well-being, in terms of perhaps the progression of the disease even?
Well, I guess we have compared some Italian and Greek background people in mainstream and ethno-specific care facilities, and what we found was that the family members were more satisfied with the care and in the ethno-specific facilities, and also one of the main things we were looking at was communication, was that the residents were communicating a lot more in the ethno-specific facilities. So in the mainstream facilities, they were likely to be quite socially isolated and didn't have co-residents or their peers who spoke together with them in their common language. So I guess our concern was it could be quite isolating in mainstream care facilities. Mm. And there was a real range from what we've found of how many resources were employed in mainstream facilities when people were the sole representative of their language. So while some facilities were linking in to community organisations, accessing a lot of services, having very inclusive activity programs that maybe didn't rely on language as much, had a lot of involvement of family members, a lot of use of interpreters, these were all really positive things. There were other facilities who were really struggling with that. So we found a big variation in what the facilities were doing. And the ethno-specific facilities, I guess an important point to make is that they're a minority of aged care facilities.
So yes, I wondered about that.
Yeah, I think it's
and
about
10%. And are they 10%. Set up 10%? Are they set up by community groups quite specifically and funded by community groups?
Yeah, so you can see with that they're not going to be available to the majority of people from migrant backgrounds. So some of the bigger groups like Italian and Greek people may have access to ethno-specific facilities, but more geographically dispersed populations or smaller or newly arrived populations won't have access to these types of facilities. And even for the larger groups, they often have long waiting lists, or they might be in a particular location. I think in that package we heard before that woman was visiting her mother 5 times a week. Mm. If you're visiting your parent 5 times a week, you're probably going to want them to be in a facility local to you. So I guess there's a lot of practical considerations. They do offer a really useful service, a really valuable service, but they're not realistic for most people.
Susanna, the Federation of Ethnic Communities Councils of Australia said in a report earlier this year that, quote, aged care facilities fail to provide culturally appropriate care, including a lack of homeland food or traditional medicine. And that interested us, and I wonder what expectations we should have of aged care providers to be equipped to provide such specific needs if, for example, they're not ethno-specific facilities.
Yeah, I mean, aged care facilities are attempting to provide person-centred care to provide for the individual needs of each resident, you know, irrespective of their background. So, you know, the food and the cultural needs are really important to residents, and, you know, the culture is one part of that. And some of our satisfaction surveys have really brought that out, and some of the family members, the food was the main thing they asked to be improved. Mm. Another thing that was really seen as something that would really improve care and was really important was having one bilingual staff member. So one person they could communicate with and who could communicate with their family member.
And that indeed might be, John Watkins, CEO of Alzheimer's Australia, a key thing that governments, and you pointed to the need for government commitment to meet this challenge, that government could aid aged care facilities with, making sure that there's language diversity amongst the staff of aged care.
Well, they have to do that increasingly with the numbers that are coming through. And that's part of the story when someone makes that difficult decision, the most difficult decision to place a loved one into a residential aged care facility. You'd like to think that what they're going into is as close as possible to their experience previously. Now, you can't apply, you know, every language, every person. We know that, but you can certainly do it a lot better than it's done at the moment. But it's all that time prior to that. The biggest problem is with diagnosis, and that's where the language barrier causes real delays, and the stigma in certain communities means that some people just are not diagnosed before death or diagnosed very late.
And that's so is that up to the medical community to better facilitate translation needs?
It's up to all of us, Natasha. It's up to the medical community, absolutely, to the aged care facilities and to the government. And it's the government that holds policy levers and has the funding to do these things. I'm starting to use the language, it's a human rights crisis that is developing, you know, in every street and suburb of this nation. It's quiet at the moment. We're dealing with older people, and for that reason, a lot of people ignore it. But it's growing and it's real, and something needs to be done.
We heard in that report the success of link workers, people from migrant communities who put those in need in touch with services. They have the language, they have the knowledge. What would you like governments to do tomorrow?
Well, we've got three link workers at Alzheimer's Australia in New South Wales, a Syrian, Croatian, Cambodian.
Three link workers.
You know, when we're talking about Sydney has a population of 25% of Sydney residents, non-English speaking backgrounds. We just don't touch the surface, even in those three communities. We need extensive link workers throughout Australia that are funded by the federal government. That's a start.
Susanna, finally to you, what would you like to see done tomorrow on this issue?
Yeah, I think the link workers are a start, as John said. We need so much more, so many more resources, funding put into research, and help for individual aged care facilities to better meet the needs. So even just giving that example we were talking about having a bilingual staff member, looking at what can they do in the facility? Can they provide some basic language training for staff? Can they use language cards or picture cards or use technology to produce words in the resident's language? So just those really practical day-to-day things, I think, can be implemented straight away.
Look, I thank you both for joining us today to talk about this issue. It's going to affect so many of us, so many of our families, and is already. John Watkins, CEO of Alzheimer's Australia, thank you very much.
Thanks, Natasha.
And Dr. Susanna Runci, a clinical psychologist and formerly a researcher at the Aged Mental Health Research Institute Unit at Monash University. Thank you, Susanna.
Thank you, Natasha.
And an interesting tweet from Sally. Music therapy is powerful. Don't need much language to access their records and play them. The universal language, music. Look, Natasha Mitchell with you on Life Matters here on ABCRN. Across Australia, one of Australia's most loved children's authors next, Nadia Wheatley in the studio. Acclaimed Australian children's author Nadia Wheatley has captivated generations of, well, big and little readers alike with her stories of place and people and memory. Books like My Place, The House That Was Eureka, Playground, they might be on your bookshelves, they are on mine. For her latest book called Flight, Nadia has teamed up with the celebrated children's book illustrator Armin Grieder to tell a powerful story of displacement. And in some sense, it's a book for our times, as millions of men and women and children take flight across Europe, escaping conflicts in Syria and Iraq and beyond. And Australia continues to wrestle with its own response to those seeking asylum. But it is a story from other pockets of history too, as you'll hear, from the biblical story of the flight into Egypt, from Nadia's own childhood, as it turns out too, which was pressed into stark relief for her during a visit earlier this year to the site of the notorious Bergen-Belsen concentration camp in Germany, which after the war became a camp for displaced survivors of the war and of the Nazis. And I've seen footage of that liberation of that camp, and it breaks your heart. And Nadia joins me this morning in the Life Matters studio. Great to have you.
Good morning, Natasha.
I mean, children and parents will read this book, Flight, through the lens of present events and the asylum seeker stories they're seeing in the news. In fact, that wasn't the trigger for you for writing this story.
It wasn't the trigger, and indeed it was 9 or 10 years ago that the idea started to take shape in my mind when I was in Rome over Christmas and I saw a Presepe, a little nativity tableau in a church. This was the time of the Second Gulf War, and instead of the usual shepherds and angels and wise men and all the paraphernalia that we get in these kinds of tableaus, there was simply a bed of sand. Then in it, there was a tiny little hovel with two adult figures, a man and a woman, and a little baby. Coming down from the sky, instead of the angels, there were helicopter gunships. And rolling across the sand, remember this is in a chapel in a church, rolling across the sand were little toy tanks with camouflage markings. Wow. And in front of this tableau was a pile of sandbags, life-size sandbags, and on front of them there was the Italian peace flag saying Pace, peace, on a rainbow background. And as I say, this was just in the lead-up to the Second Gulf War, and I suddenly...
There was a pacifist priest in that church somehow.
It was a very powerful message coming out.
And not your average nativity scene by any stretch.
Not at all, because usually these are sort of like something out of Disney with all kinds of figures and figurines and pagan figurines, as well as things that look like they come out of the cornflakes packet. And so I suddenly thought about the very last scene of what we might call the Christmas story, when Joseph in a dream is warned by an angel to take the young child and his mother and flee into Europe. And this, of course, is because the king, Herod, wants to kill the baby, who he's heard is a rival king. And when he's unable to do that, we have the episode known as the Massacre of the Innocents, in which all the boy babies under about the age of two are slaughtered. Now, this is a fable, really. There's no evidence that King Herod, who's a historical figure, did this. But it's a welcome reminder that what some people think of as the Holy Family, in fact, were a family of refugees. And that was what stuck in my mind. And the other thing about that story is, wonderfully for artists across the centuries, it ends at the moment when this little family, a young woman, an older man, and a little baby, set off into the desert. We do not know what happened afterwards for at least 12 years in this fable or this legend, or if you like, this story.
And you take us across the desert with Armin Grieder's incredibly powerful pastel drawings or pencil drawings, stark, brutal almost.
Yes, they're very different from other depictions that we might see on Christmas cards, which come from, let's say, a Renaissance art tradition, which shows a comfortable woman riding on a donkey and a safe and happy little baby. These are a lot of darkness, but also a lot of light. And we see the landscape of the desert. We see the difficulty of the journey in the story as I've written it. It's updated. We see tanks rolling across the desert, just as they did in that nativity tableau I saw in Rome. And when that happens, the donkey bolts. And on that donkey, there's the food and the water for the journey. So all this couple are left with is the little bag of water that the man, he's unnamed, they're not Joseph and Mary, they're an unnamed family.
It's nameless, it's placeless, it's faceless.
Yes. And off they go, continuing their pilgrimage, looking for asylum. They don't know where they might find this asylum. They don't know if they're going to make it through the journey, which takes about 2 nights and 2 days.
In fact, there's an intense family connection in some way to the landscapes represented in this book and this story of dislocation and place and displacement. It's a complicated story from your own life.
It is. People often say to writers, where do you get the idea from? And I've just told you, as it were, the outer skin of the onion, which is the story of seeing this nativity tableau and thinking of this archetypal family of refugees. But when I thought deeper into the origins or inspiration of the story, I realised that there were at least two sources in my own childhood. My mother was a nurse in the Australian Army in Palestine in World War II, and as a child I would look at her album of war photos. Though they were little black and white brownie box pictures, they were of a desert landscape, a landscape of sand dunes, some with biblical place names on them, like the River Jordan, and also pictures of Arab children in the streets and people in the markets, people who could have stepped out of that landscape 2,000 years ago. So it was like seeing past and present accreting and coming together. And my mother also had a little pictorial New Testament that her grandfather had given her when she was 7 years old, and that too had desert landscapes in it. So I think that's where the fascination with that particular desert landscape and that sense of two timescapes of a story over 2,000 years coming together.
There's the landscape, but there's also these stories of displacement that actually entered your life very early on as a child, and then we'll also get to your own dislocation within your family. But your mum goes to work at Belsen, the concentration camp that was liberated, or
well, she, my dad was actually at Belsen. My mother was in other camps in Germany. So after World War II ended, but whilst the war was still on in the Pacific, but after it ended in Europe, she flew an 11-day journey by aeroplane to Germany to start work with what was then the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration. So the first NGO, the first United Nations organisation working with refugees, or in those days the term was displaced persons. And when she arrived in 1945, there were up to 8 or 9 million displaced persons left in Germany after World War II. And in addition, there were another 9 million refugees coming in from Eastern Europe. So an enormous refugee crisis.
And people who were coming out of concentration camps as well in a terrible state.
People from concentration camps, some of them Jewish victims, many of them Jewish victims of the Nazi regime, but also other people from Eastern Europe who'd been Zwangsarbeiter, forced labourers who had been also living in camps in Germany, working in the factories and the munitions fields and so on. So even after a lot of them were returned in that first year, there remained 1 million displaced persons in Germany from 46 to 51. And over a number of those years, both my parents worked with those displaced persons, with those refugees in the British zone of Germany.
Your father is a doctor. They meet, they come to Australia, they have you, just you, one child. But your mother's connection to the people that she meets in these displaced person camps lives on, doesn't it?
Well, it did very much. When I was very young, from up to about the age of six, we had people that my mother had met over there in the camps, Polish people mostly, Eastern European people, coming and living in our house. We did have a large house which had a flat on the side and also some living accommodation underneath it. Mm-hmm. And I remember a succession of these people who would stay for 3 weeks, 3 months, 6 months while they were getting their English together, maybe getting their qualifications or papers together. And for a little Anglo-Australian middle-class child such as me, that was a very unusual experience. Mm. But also unusual was my name, Nadia. Mm. And my mother had named me after one of the people she'd met in one of the camps. I know nothing else about that person except that she was a displaced person. I don't know her surname, her country, her background.
I think your uncle took exception to that name, didn't he?
Well, my dairy farmer uncle said that he didn't want to have a niece with a refo name in his family. Of course, once he met me, that changed and we actually stayed there. But it's typical of the prejudice that was around in Australia. We're talking about the early 1950s. And indeed, I can remember at school, at a dear little middle-class nursery school on the North Shore, kids talking about the fact that there were Poles living at my place, the Poles, as if they were long telegraph poles, I used to think about. And this sense of me having a refo name was present in schooling. And indeed, through my schooling, there were some teachers who would make an elaborate mess of mispronouncing Nadia. It's a name quite hard to mispronounce. You say it as you see it, but it was a kind of knee-jerk reaction to a foreign name at a time when all the other girls were called Jennifer, Elizabeth, Anne and Susan. It was as if it was weird and pretentious to have this foreign name.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. Nadia Wheatley is with me, acclaimed children's author. We're talking about her new book, Flight, which is written by Nadia, illustrated by the incredible children's book illustrator Armin Greeter. And it has all sorts of personal tendrils for Nadia. And there's another layer to this too, because in some sense your own childhood became displaced, dislocated, because your mum died when you were just nine. Your father goes back to Britain. You're left alone in Australia, in a state of dislocation too, which is in some sense, it does have parallels to the refugee story.
I think children do find their own experience or stories represented in things that they read. Mm. So, yes, actually for me the dislocation happened twice. When I was about seven, my mother suddenly disappeared. I know now she had been ill for some time and she went into hospital, but I wasn't told where she went. So with one day's notice, I was suddenly packed up with only my school uniform, no toys, nothing, and sent over to live with relatives and never again went back to that home, never again connected with that place, with that house, with my beloved rocking horse, with some of my toys. So literally that was a time of going with one bag, admittedly to some relatives, but changing schools, as we know, is a big change for some children. And I changed schools three times in about 9 months. And then after my mother and I, having sort of lost our father during that, my father during that process, just after we got settled again finally in our own home, within a couple of weeks of that, I now know she was diagnosed with cancer, and that long ending took about 9 months, but she was in hospital for some of that time. And then again, when she finally died, or a couple of weeks before she died, again, I was parceled up and, or that's how I felt. I felt like a parcel. Mm. And I was delivered to the family of one of the girls in my class. And I stayed there for about another 6 or 7 years. So it was, and again, I never went back to my home.
In
I
some
never
sense,
had
alone
that
in the world.
Ability to go and do my own packing, to take my own things. Mm. And yes, it was very much a sense of dislocation, a sense of being shifted from one place to another, even though I didn't have the enormous shifting that happens for refugees, a shifting of continents. Certainly I'm not making my experience similar to people who travel in dangerous boats, who make terrible journeys like the family's journey that I try to describe in Flight. But I think for many of the readers of this book, they too won't have had that experience. You know, it would be presumptuous for me to write a book for refugee children. It's a book for young Australians, hopefully young people from other countries, to connect to that experience.
You went back to Belsen, where your father had worked. There's not a lot of love lost for you on your father. He wasn't a kind man in your life. A tough relationship, and then an absent one altogether. What did going back to Belsen bring to you, to your sense of self? You've talked about this on Radio National earlier this year, but in the context of this story, Flight, what did it tell you?
Well, for me, place is always a highly significant factor. And, you know, maybe this is partly due to being displaced twice in my childhood. All my stories start from a place and then I map a place, and into the place I get the people who become fictional characters, and then I get my plot.
And those layers of history.
And similarly, as a historian, which I began as before I became a fiction writer, it's always important to me to go to the place where things occurred. So it was when I was walking Belsen, and Belsen is actually two sites. There's the site of the concentration camp, and then a couple of kilometres away, there's the site of the displaced persons camp, which is where my father was superintendent of the hospital. Mm. And by walking the place initially, which was back in 2014, in the springtime, I got a sense of the history. And then I was invited back this April for the 70th anniversary of the liberation, which was incredible because there were thousands of people there, including survivors and children of survivors.
And I'm going to include a link to the incredible interviews you gave Michael Cathcart and Philip Adams about that experience. There's so much more to it. But this book, what do you hope people will get out of it? What are children getting out of it? It's a dark book.
It's a dark book, and I wouldn't be giving it to a little child before she or he goes to bed. Yeah. We have a tradition of what we call young adult picture books. So I would be thinking you'd be reading it when you're 10 up to 18 or 80. And indeed, I've got a lot of grandmothers interested in the book. So I hope it's a window into the experience of a family. It's about a family, a very young mother, a very little baby, and their experience of seeking refuge, seeking asylum. And readers bring to that as much as they can.
It's a powerful story that you tell, and it's a great pleasure to have you in the Life Matters studio, Nadia Wheatley. Thank you.
Thank you, Natasha. Great to talk to you.
Nadia Wheatley, her book is Flight. Details on the Life Matters website. Next on the program, Bob Brown is joining us, coming up to the news.